Hello, I'm Eddie Merckx. Welcome to the VeloCast.
And welcome to another edition of the VeloCast. My name is Scott.
And I'm John.
Well, coming up on this week's show, we look at all the action at the Amgen Tour of California, Mario Cipollini calls Sky, Gammon and HTC slackers, our new glorious cycling leader, and we discuss mechanical doping. But first, Team Katusha's Evgeny Petrov won what was an incredible 11th stage at the Giro d'Italia from Lucera to L'Aquila. The Russians' victory also saw the general classification almost completely reordered, with Richie Porte from Saxo Bank taking over the lead from Alexander Vinokourov.
Do we think he's the first Tasmanian to hold a Grand Tour leader's jersey?
I certainly can't think of any other off the top of my head.
No, me neither. This has been, I mean, I'm exhausted and we're only, what, 11 days into the race. I've got no emotional energy left at all.
No, this was supposed to be Sprinter's Week. This is supposed to be where we all relax for a wee bit and things get back to normal, but it hasn't been. I mean, the major talking point here came after 20 kilometres when 56 riders escaped off the front of the peloton and built up a lead of over 17 minutes.
How the hell did they let that happen? I mean, seriously, because it wasn't no-hopers. We had Sastre, Wiggins was in the break. So, important riders up there. And, you know, the peloton, you actually can't really call it the peloton because half of them were up the road. But the guys who were behind let it go out to 17 minutes at one point.
Well, the question there is, I mean, we've got three teams, essentially, who should have been in control of the race at the point where the lead was starting to build up to worrying proportions. And those, of course, were Liquigas, Astana and BMC. Now, why didn't... I mean, I can kind of understand Liquigas because they had riders away in the break. So the automatic reaction there is to sit back and say, well, if you want to chase it down, you chase it down. But there must surely come a point where the plan on the road has to change when the lead gets so great that it's completely throwing the GC off kilter.
Well, you know, I've been watching it with Italian commentary.
Yes, and Colombian at one point, I think.
I tried Colombian, it was too much for me. You know, it's just like drugs, you know, the Colombian stuff's just too potent. But REI at one point postulated that Vino was sick. And in fact, you know, his teeth were chattering and he didn't look his usual hyped up, shall we say, self during the race. You're right about leaky gas. I mean, they had folk up the road, so they didn't have to chase. So it was all going to come down on the shoulders of BMC. And I think they just played chicken for too long. And by the time they woke up and realised that the race was turned on its head, it was too late.
12:46 was the eventual time gap there. With 8 kilometres to go, the leaders began to attack each other, with David Miller being the first to have a go. Quickly brought back to the group with Jerome Pinot from Quickstep being the next to try and escape. The Stage 5 winner's lead wasn't more than 100 metres before he was swept up as Carlos Sastre and Gerdemann both made their moves. Under the kilometre banner, the German had a small lead, but he was caught and passed by Petrov, who timed his move perfectly and hung on to take the stage up a tough uphill finish.
Easy for you to say.
No, it wasn't.
I tell you,
I mean, this literally happened, you know, 20
half
minutes
an hour ago. Yeah, 20 minutes ago. My heart went out to David Harman, actually. Essentially, I watched that. I was so excited, and I thought, I better listen to this in English so I can understand what's actually going on. So I turned on Eurosport, and poor Harman got entirely the wrong guy as the stage winner. I mean, for ages. And I was shouting, it's Petrov! It's Petrov! He couldn't hear me. Obviously. It's an understandable mistake, because the dire conditions for riders makes it almost impossible to commentate. You know, these guys aren't sitting with the 37, 42-inch plasmas that we watch it on.
Yeah.
They're in cramped conditions with tiny wee tellies. So, I love Harman. He's a great commentator, and we should forgive his wee faux pas today.
Yes.
But I've got no idea who's going to win now. I mean, I had a really set idea how the race was going to go to the end, and it's literally turned on its head. I mean, Sastre, who I'd dismissed, is now the leading major rider.
Yeah, I mean, I also had a very clear idea how this race was going to go, and it was written in my notes for this week's show, which I've just basically had to rip up and throw away.
If we're a bit dishevelled, bear with us.
Well, Petrov himself says, I'm very, very happy. I have to thank all the team. They helped me a lot today. Anna, I won, he shouted to his Italian wife live on Italian television. Now, Alexander Vinokourov, who was the pink jersey wearer up until the end of today's stage, said, the Giro is not over yet. I did my best, but I had the jersey for a few days. It was a bad day for the team, but now we'll see what happens. There's still 10 days to go.
Well, the other thing that happened for Astana, I think Gasparotto abandoned. So, I mean, he was really strong in the early season and would have been a good lieutenant for Vino. So the team's weakened by that. Mm. But it's all to play for. I mean, I'm gagging for the rest of this race now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly been dull up until now, though, has it? As we moved into what was billed as Sprinter's Week at the Giro, it seemed that Tyler Farrar was the man to beat with a sensational finish.
That's fair enough. I'm never buying any glasses with transitions lenses, though.
Why?
It's a Eurosport thing again. I mean, in between getting the disgustingly white suit of Contador and his ballroom dancing and people's you get every 5 seconds or something there's an advert with Tyler Farrar and bloody transitions lenses. I'm sick of them.
Well, Julian Dean acted as the perfect decoy for Tyler Farrar, who totally outclassed his rival sprinters with a ton of speed that left most of them in his wake. And he said after the race, I have the strongest team in the world leading me out. It certainly makes it easier for me winning. I'm confident in my guys.
It's making Greipel look like a bit of an idiot, though, isn't he? After all, he's mouthing off before the race about, you know, how he was as good as Cav. I was so sure that Greipel would be fired up for this race that I put him in my fantasy bag of washing team. Mm. And he's done nout.
Well, I mean, what we're going to do here is just kind of look back at the key stages across the last week to see what stuck out for us. And Farrar obviously winning two stages in what was supposed to be, you know, the dull sprinters week, sorry, for all those people that love the sprinters races. But stage nine itself, I mean, having strength and depth is no bad thing, but it certainly doesn't look too good for Andre Greipel. As you say, he was supposed to be proving a point with Cavendish over at the Tour of California. But
the point he proved is that if he's in any team with another sprinter, the other guy's going to win.
Yeah, so it would seem. This, of course, was stage nine, where Australian sprinter Matt Goss became HTC Columbia's plan B, with Andre Greipel being nowhere to be seen.
To be fair, actually, I'm only being bad to him because he's costing me points in my team.
Oh, is that what it is?
But he's definitely not performed to the level we expected. I mean, we talked at length about how we expected him to be incredibly motivated to show what he could do in a major stage. It hasn't happened for him. But HTC have still come up with the goods, which, as you say, it's a good sign of strength and depth.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt Goss said after the race, I'm certainly very happy. This is the best win of my career. I'm delighted. I was still trying to help Andre, but he wasn't there when there was a split with 10 kilometres to go. He came back and I looked after him for most of the last few kilometres, but at the 400 metre mark, I thought, if he's on my wheel, he'll pass me in the sprint. But he wasn't there, so I took my opportunity to win.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing that you've got to look at is this must be the best Grand Tour for Australia ever. I mean, you've had Evans just being great, actually. I mean, really good until today.
Well, we'll come to yeah. Evans at a moment.
Matt Goss, and now you've got a Tasmanian leading the race.
Well, moving back somewhat as the Giro hit the mountains for the first time, it was certainly living up to its promise of high drama. And Chris Anker Sorensen took an impressive victory on stage 8, which, as I say, was the first in the mountains.
He's an ugly bugger on a bike, he really is. Steve McCluskey actually said that if Cadel Evans was the bag of washing, then Chris Ankersaurusson was, a spin dryer taken off into orbit or something. I can't remember the exact thing. But I mean, the first thing, he looked like he had really bad constipation in his face. I mean, he looked like he was straining for something. And his body's just all over the place. I was shouting to him, you know, to get on to Eric Bowen from Fit Tech, because he needs somebody to do a bike fit on him. He looks terrible.
Yeah, he did.
But by God, he's got some courage.
Mm, definitely. He said after the stage, I'm really, really happy. It's a great victory. This is the first mountain stage of the Giro, which is one of the biggest races in the world. 7 weeks ago, I broke my right collarbone, so I wasn't sure I'd even be here at the Giro, and it's an incredible comeback for me.
I take note, Thor Hushovd. Because he's got 2 more weeks, so he's a Jesse if he doesn't win a stage.
Sorensen reached the finish line 30 seconds ahead of Simone Stortoni from Colnago, who was also part of a breakaway consisting of 17 riders, which got clear with over 100 kilometres left in the stage.
I kind of wanted Stortoni to win because he'd been the agitator. Another brave ride. I mean, it's just been brilliant. I'm sorry, I sound like a broken record, but I'm still high after watching that stage half an hour ago. It's brilliant.
I think there was some question over how Alexander Vinokourov was going to fare when the road started to go up, because really that's the kind of first uphill test he's had. I mean, he did look incredibly comfortable on the flat throughout the early part of last week, but he certainly looked...
Nah, he looked fine.
He looked fine again.
It looked like somebody was going to win the Giro.
He did, but today's changed all that. He said after the race, I felt a bit tired today after a hard stage yesterday, but it was the same for everyone. Amigo Famalotto was the first team to ride behind the breakaway, then Lamptey did it. As for myself, I controlled Evans, so it was a perfect day for us. Bradley Wiggins lost time in the climb, but just only 26 seconds. And David Miller... conceded 17 minutes 55 and fell from third to 33rd overall.
He made up for that today.
He certainly did. I think the highlight for me of the Giro thus far, as I still really haven't got my head around what happened today, was Saturday's incredible mud-soaked struggle through Tuscany, where the rain turned the Strada Bianchi from its normal white to a beleaguered brown.
That's the best stage in any Grand Tour I can actually think of off the top of my head.
That's some claim.
It was better than Lance getting a kick in on Alpe d'Huez where everybody attacked him. It was just everything that I love about cycling. And for a while, I even forgot I hated Vinokourov, because I knew I said it, you know, I said last week I'd suspended it, but you know, it takes a while to get over that. And Evans, see if I'd read a report at this stage in Cycling Weekly or whatever when I was a boy, I'm sure Evans would be my favourite rider forever, because that jersey deserves to be in his shoulders. It was a stunning ride.
Yeah, Cadel Evans used his experience as a mountain bike rider to his advantage and looked to be the most comfortable on the slippery surface of the Strada. Alexander Vinokourov, who had been looking to control the race after a crash by former leader Vincenzo Nibali, but the Australian was able to match the Astana's rider's every attack. However, it wasn't the final kilometre of the stage that Evans took control on the uneven surface, which formed the run-in to the finish, as he surged away from his companions to take victory. And in spectacular style, for one reason and one reason only. And that reason was?
I teared him, I genuinely did, because he looked down at his jersey, wiped the rainbow stripes clean, and just, you know, gave a proper salute. He looked like a true champion.
Well, I mean, we're so used to seeing, you know, it's standard protocol if you've won a race, you know, and a breakaway or top of a mountain stage, you sort your cap, you zip up your jersey, make sure your glasses are on, make sure the sponsor's well seen, so on and so forth. But to look down and see that the rainbow stripes were covered in mud and had to be cleaned was just...
That's class.
Class.
Pure
absolute class.
Class.
Absolutely.
The thing about the Strada Bianchi, I think a lot of people will appreciate this. It was like Paris-Roubaix on steroids, because although they didn't have the bumping, it was incredibly slippy. I mean, people were going down left, right and centre. It was adding weight to the bikes. It was probably, I mean, I would hate to have been the mechanic cleaning the team bikes that night because of the amount of grit and crap on them.
You'd be as well just throwing them out.
Aye, just throw them out and start again. But the other thing that was missed and didn't come across clearly in the telly, I think, is that some of these bits were 16% grades. You know, on surfaces where you've got difficulty getting traction, they couldn't wear glasses because, you know, they completely caked up. So that grit was going into their eyes. They couldn't see where they were going. I mean, they were constantly wiping their eyes. And it was just, it was the hell of the South. I mean, it was just inspiring racing from true hard men. So, chapeau, guys. Brilliant stage.
Cadell Evans after the stage said, "It was a spectacular stage. We prepared things in fine detail for the dirt roads. It suited me because I raced mountain bikes for 7 years, and that was a huge help for me. I felt strong in the finale and at the finish. I wasn't afraid of going a bit early in the sprint because I wanted to use my strength to win it." I mean, at that point, I mean, I know things have changed, as we keep saying, things have seemed to have changed substantially today. But really, from that point on, I've kind of felt that Cadell Evans and Alexander Vinokourov have made the race.
Yeah, it's been a proper tussle.
Vinokourov himself said that though the last 45 kilometres were worse than Paris-Roubaix. It was a terrible stage because we went hard right from the start. I'm sorry that Nibali crashed in a key moment of the race, but it's difficult to be a gentleman 30 kilometres from the finish with the dirt roads to come. I was at the front because it was a critical part of the race and wanted to hit the dirt roads first. I don't think there's a place for dirt roads like this in a stage race like the Giro. In one day, this is Alexander Vinokourov, in a one day race, yes, but not in a stage race. And I have seen a few complaints regarding the Strade Bianche along these lines, but I think Vino was the first to suggest that it's not suitable for a Grand Tour.
Aye, get over it, son.
I mean, okay, I'll try and play devil's advocate here, because you know I think it was an absolute awesome stage. Are the risks too high?
No. Seriously, I mean, a few years ago, the Tour de France thought about using the Breton equivalent of Strade Bianche. In fact, I raved about them when we were in Brittany this year, about the, you know, the unsurfaced roads there.
That's right, yeah.
And they talked about using that and thought, no, you know, they're a bit too hard for the wee devils and bikes, you know, poor wee souls. But this year, Prudhomme as well is chucking the cobbles of Paris-Roubaix into the Tour. These guys... It's really refreshing because suddenly the Tour isn't just about who can time trial fastest and hang with the climbers.
Yeah.
Or in Contador, you know, who can hang with the, or who can time trial fastest and absolutely destroy the best climbers in the world.
Mm.
It's about being a complete rounded cyclist. You know, it's not just about winning the race, it's about avoiding losing it. And that can only improve it for spectators. I mean, sure, it's harder for the pros, but, you know, that's what they get paid for.
Yeah. Well, there was an article on just that. Talking to Marc Madio, director sportif at Française des Jeux, and double Paris-Roubaix winner, who said, "These gravelled roads are perfect for pure cycling. This is what makes bike riders heroes. Race organisers must not be afraid of using this kind of course."
It's easy for him to say. He just about floated over the cobbles. He's one of the most stylish cobbles riders I've ever seen. But he's right. And I mean, Madio's always also he's with us in the Get Radios Out of Riders' Ears campaign as well.
Yeah, he also went on to say, in fact, so before we get there, I think it was him that was suggesting to Christophe Prudhomme to use some of the Breton roads previous Tour de France's, but on radio communication, he says, "Cycling will be even more pure when communication via earpieces are banned. The battle on the Strade Bianche was great, but I still noticed some hesitation by the riders when they heard from their team car that, Vincenzo Nibali and Ivan Basso were back. There was no reason to wait. The race had to go on, and I'm glad they did it at full gas."
I tell you, I've been looking, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about and looking at the Virtual Musette website. See if you did a monochrome version of the picture of Cadell Evans crossing the line. It could be somebody for the 20s.
Yeah, it's that was exactly what I thought.
Stunning.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, speaking of Vincenzo Nibali, the Italian had taken the pink jersey as his Liquigas squad showed impressive form earlier in the week during the team time trial.
Now, was it impressive or was it incredible?
I'm going to go with impressive.
When did Liquigas become a force in team time trial? I mean, seriously.
Well, the last story in the race section this week may go some way to explaining.
I tell you, they spanked Sky.
By 13 seconds.
Right. And the thing is, as well, Liquigas actually looked composed. I think they finished with all of their riders. Other teams were blown apart.
Well, so. Astana being chief amongst them, who... I think they only finished with four riders.
And that was my favourite comment, actually, was it on Twitter? Where, I mean, it's nearly a week ago now, and I'm getting senile, so I can't remember who it was that was dropped. But the fifth guy, who did a storming job to hang on in the last few K. I mean, an absolutely storming job.
Yeah.
And, you know, turned himself inside out. But somebody on Twitter said, you know, that guy's sister's being sold to a pimp in Kazakhstan tonight. because Vino didn't look happy.
No, he did not look happy at all after the race. Nibali himself said the whole team did an amazing ride. We went really, really strong. I pushed a lot of times and Basso went really strong, Bodnar too. They were all good today. I mean, I love the team time trial. I think it should be obligatory in every Grand Tour. It's just fantastic to watch that train.
Yeah, no, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But leaky gas, come on.
Well, as John put it in the prep for today's show, deja vu for Van der Velde, as for the second year in a row, Christian Van der Velde crashed out of the Giro Italia on the third stage.
I think he just likes his holidays in May.
Yeah, I think he just likes putting his feet up, shows a bit for a couple of days, and then goes to the beach.
Well, you know, every time that he turns up fit for a tour, and the obvious guys who would be a given to win aren't there, and you think, oh, you know, Christian could do a good ride here. The team are there to support him. He falls off and hurts himself. It's not a good career path.
Well, Van der Velde went down in a pile-up with about 25 kilometres to go, and it was a really, really windy stage on Monday. I mean, so much so that, in fact, across the first couple of days of the Giro, I was wondering whether it wasn't being held in Scotland and not Holland, as the weather was just changing continually.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying about the Strada Bianchi that they're Jessies and they should stop moaning about it. But something needs to be done about the street furniture in, you know, in the lowlands, because it's becoming a serious issue in single day races and now in tours. I mean, with the crosswinds, there were just carnage on many occasions. There were some of the nastiest crashes I've seen. You know, people going into Armco and all sorts of stuff and disappearing over verges and running into bollards in the middle of the road. It's just bad luck. But it's the first week of a major Grand Tour. You know, the peloton are nervous. They've got peak fitness for a race they've prepared for. They all want to do well. And they're funneling through narrow roads in horrible conditions. So it's just bad luck.
Yep. Team officials announced that Van der Velde had broken his right clavicle. Via team statement, he said, "It is frustrating that it has happened for the second year in a row here, especially coming off Tyler's win on Sunday. I really wanted to be here and be part of everything that comes next, whether it be helping David get into pink or just being part of the team. I'll be rooting for them at home, though, and will do everything I can to be at the start line for the Tour de France." Thoughts on that?
I'm sure he will. I mean, it's... You know, if you look at Sorensen winning 7 weeks after breaking his collarbone, he's got a chance.
Yeah. Now, before today's stage, anyone who had a bet on Carlos Sastre at this year's Giro must have been tearing up the betting slip, as the Spaniard, one of the contenders for the overall victory, was languishing in 21st place and over 8 minutes back, but is now... I think if we calculate correctly...
He's late, seventh, I think.
Seventh or eighth.
And nine back.
Right.
But the guys in front of him aren't of the same calibre as Vino and Evans and everybody.
Which now puts him, as you said earlier, one of the contenders.
Particularly
for.
When you factor in that he's a known force in the third week of Grand Tours. You know, he's got stamina. And the last week is brutal climbing.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Who knows?
Shrugging my shoulders makes really good podcasting, doesn't it? He talked about how he wasn't happy with his form and condition. You know, the team were making, he'll come good later noises. A bit of luck today combined with some really intelligent riding. I mean, he was driving hard at the front when he felt he had to.
Yeah, which was impressive, I think, because I think given that he had been involved in two crashes on the first stage and in stage seven, it would have been easy, I think, being so far out of contention, just for him to put his head down and cruise around the rest of Italy. See, to ride that intelligently and be involved in the race, I thought was really impressive.
See, if I was him, though, every time I felt, you know, my head was going to drop and I needed to motivate myself, I'd just think about that comment that Armstrong made about that tour being a joke one that Sastre won. And I'd go, I'm going to show that, you know, let's sort him out.
And in fairness to Lance Armstrong, I think he did apologise for that sometime after the fact. But yeah, it will still stick. Yeah.
You know, it's going to stick and it's going to sting. So, you know, he's motivated to perform. He found himself in the right place almost by accident, because nobody must have thought that, you know, that break was going to go that far away. And he capitalised on it intelligently. And given the third week, you know, he could win it.
Mm.
He could genuinely win it.
I still can't believe 17 minutes. What were they thinking?
Daft buggers.
Yes. Now, tousle-haired, toga-wearing former sprinter Mario Cipollini, who retired with 42 wins at the Giro, used his La Gazzetta dello Sport column to take a dig at teams Garmin Transitions, HTC, Columbia and Sky for their lack of organisation to produce a sprint finish. Cipo said, "I keep having the impression that the big budget teams are badly organised and assembled. Sky and Garmin race poorly and have not once been able to launch the sprint correctly."
Well, he's right.
Damning stuff.
But there's a reason for it. And the reason for it is, with a couple of exceptions when Paolo Salvadelli was racing for Saico and was, you know, was in a position to do well, other than that, that entire team was devoted to being Cipo's train. That was its sole task, was to deliver him, you know, to the point where he could unleash his meaty thighs and cross the line first. The big budget teams he's talking about essentially are looking at GC riders. They're not just based around the, you know, a sprinter's train. Other than HTC on occasion, when, you know, when Cav's, you know, when Cav's in absolutely stellar form. So their train's always going to be weaker. I mean, I think at one point Bradley Wiggins was part of the lead-out train for Sky, which is just wrong. You know, he should be sitting protected somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed, Greg Henderson from Team Sky responded to this, talking to Cycling Weekly. He said, "I don't care what he has to say. We are doing our best, and sorry if we aren't winning every time. We are just racing our bikes and doing the best we can. It's not like we're going out there and not giving 100%. Now, the battle for the general classification of the Amgen Tour of California has been hotting up over the past few days. On stage three, David Zabriskie from Garmin Transitions came away with the win, besting Michael Rogers from HTC Columbia and defending champion Levi Leipheimer from Radio Shack, who, of course, are all on the hunt for the overall title.
Bunch of Jessies again, actually. you've got stage seven of the Giro, okay? In conditions that, frankly, a seal would think were too wet to go out in. You know, horrible gritty conditions. Roads where the motorbikes must have been having as much difficulty getting traction as the bike riders. And they still brought us essentially iconic footage. I mean, just stunning footage of riders in extremis, at the limit, in, you know, evil, evil conditions. Wee bit of rain in California, not a picture to be seen.
Okay, so let's just, for clarification purposes, the Jessies to which you refer...
Oh, no, the TV people.
Oh, the TV people, not the riders, okay.
I watched the stage, is it stage two into Sacramento? I haven't managed to catch much of it, but I loved that, you know, because essentially it was a big crit finish, and the riders were getting stuck in, and what I really liked to see was that the American teams weren't scared to take it to the big boys. You know, there's everybody getting stuck in. But surely the, you know, the technological might of one of the great superpowers on Earth should be able to bring you some film with a wee bike race.
Sort it out.
Aye, or I'll be there.
Yes, well, when you're talking about that stage into Sacramento, it was actually stage one.
Senile.
That's quite
I've been ill, what can I say?
What can you say? Where the HTC train got off to a flying start, and Mark Cavendish claimed the opening stage, escorted to perfection by his Columbia teammate, Mark Renshaw. Cavendish came in ahead of Saxo Bank's Juan José Hedo and BMC's Norwegian Alexander Kristoff.
I actually thought that Cav didn't look at his imperious best. But he did show that even when he's not in good form, he's one of the best sprinters in the world. So his wee rant was partially correct the other week. You know, his team did a stunning job delivering him to where he needed to be. And as I say, the wee teams, not wee teams, that's condescending. The American teams had, you know, they'd got stuck in and mixed the race up because they're really good at crits. A huge bit of their racing circuit is crits. But HTC and Cav, you know, brought it home.
Yes, after the race, Cavendish says, "We took control of the race all day. We got swamped a couple of times towards the finish, but all I had to do was follow Renshaw's wheel and cross the line first, really. If I'm delivered to the right place, then I will cross the line first," showing that self-effacing, humble streak that we've all come to know and love.
He agrees with me. There was a picture of him on, I think it was Cyclicious, where he was at a press conference. And Fritz from Cyclicious had his copy of Cavendish's autobiography. And Cavendish saw it and said, can I have that tub, you know, and I'll do a photo shoot with it. And Fitz goes, and he looked really proud, beaming, holding up his picture of his autobiography. And he didn't. He looked like a manic depressive caveman. I mean, it must have been one of those unlucky moments, you know, where the shutter goes and it's...
You've blinked.
You've blinked and your mouth's kind of agape, but he didn't look happy.
He's claiming in a slight shift to his previous position, and I'm being a bit nitpicking here, he's claiming that his lack of results this year is not just due to the tooth infection that we've talked about a number of times, but that his preparation has been based around peaking at the Tour de France and, of course, the World Championships in October. That seems to me a slight shift, because I think it probably would have been easier for him to say, no, I'm not on form at the minute because I'm prepping for the Tour, whereas he spoke a lot about this tooth infection and how unwell he had been. It just seemed to be a bit of a shift in position.
I don't know, if it was Lance Armstrong, you'd think he's just setting them up for the sucker punch at the Tour. But I don't think Cav's that bright.
Cav's not that bright, okay.
Yeah, the stage that I ranted about was stage two, actually, which was won by Australia's Brett Lancaster in a sprint finish. But, you know, the proverbial hit the fan yesterday on the climb of... I can't believe somebody's actually called a climb this, but Bonnie Doon. The Banks and Brazel Bonnie Doon. Where Radio Shack lit the blue touch paper to the foot of the climb and then Leipheimer attacked. And Zabriskie was able to go with him and Mick Rogers. Now, there was a question on the forum about the tactics of this, and they wondered why, you know, these guys had made such an effort to only gain, you know, a paltry amount of time by the finish. The first was... The top of the climb was 20k from the top, from the finish, so it was always going to be difficult to gain time. But the real answer came when an interview with Leipheimer, where he said he wanted to get away, but those were the two guys he didn't want to get away with, you know, because he regarded them as his two biggest threats. So essentially, he didn't work as hard as he would have if he'd got away with a couple of guys who he didn't regard as threats in the GC. So it is chess and wheels. I mean, these guys are thinking when they're up there, or you know, Johan Bruneel's thinking for them when they're up there. And that's why, you know, Levi just didn't press home, because he didn't want to take the guys that he'd wanted to hurt. But, I mean, who calls a climb Bonnie Doon, for God's sake?
That's probably a Scotsman. We did send quite a few of our number off to foreign climbs across the last few hundred years.
It's too twee.
It's too sweet. Change it immediately. Now, race organisers at the Tour of California have pleaded for cooperation from fans in keeping the roads paint-free. Now, according to technical director Chuck Hodge, probably not a Scotsman, the Tour risks permit losses going forward if the traditional practice of road painting continues.
Supplying them with water-based paint.
Well, see, that would... I think there's a business opportunity here, because seemingly nobody else has thought of it.
Just have a wee tanker of paint at the bottom. Say to folk, fill your jugs, you know, get stuck in, paint what you like, and the first rain, which they clearly have a lot of, because, you know, they can't film in it. Actually, maybe means they don't have a lot, but the first rain comes along, the roads are clean again. Job's done. Because the painting on the road is part of the sport. I mean, I love it when you climb in the continent. Even now, you can see the names of riders who've been retired for 10 or 15 yes. years on some of the climbs painted on them. I mean, it's actually quite nice. It's back through history.
Absolutely. I mean, I've often wondered, though, if anyone ever complains that... I mean, it must just be about every road from Pau to Bourg-en-Bresse would be covered in 20-year-old graffiti. Do you think anybody in France or
no, Italy? I would think they're happy to see it. It's their race. Definitely. I tell you, though, can people stop painting penises ejaculating?
See, this is my theory about, you know, my wife often says, men, they're just wee boys in big boys' bodies. And I said, yes, and your point is?
And
that's just schoolboy humour. I don't think you're ever going to stop that.
The one member of my family who's a really keen cyclist is my daughter. And she's 14. And as a dad, I'm going through that transition, you know, that transition where she's becoming a woman and I have to adjust to that. And it's not helped by big erect penises in the middle of the road, and, you know, during the Tour de France. So syringes I can live with, but genitalia, leave it out, folks.
It's not big and it's not clever.
Well, it is big, but it's not
it's
clever.
Not clever. Now, apparently in 2009, the Lance Armstrong Foundation distributed yellow chalk along the route, and Chuck Hodge did report that he saw a decrease in paint in last year's race, but chalk's not right.
No, you need paint.
You need paint.
It would be easy enough to do it so it washed off after a couple of rains.
Yes, coming for 2011, the patent pending Velocast soluble paint spray for roads of California.
The corporation grows.
Now, Lance Armstrong, who we kind of mentioned a moment ago, continues to talk down his chances of Tour de France victory this year. Talking ahead of the Tour of California, the 39-year-old Texan admitted that there are days I have doubts.
Well, that's a first.
It is a first.
And he's never said that before.
I've had this kind of recurring theme. There seems to have been a number of interviews now where he's talked down his chances somewhat. And I've always said, first of all, I've asked the question, is this more mind games from Lance? Because we've been so used to them over the past 10 years. And I've said continually that, no, there seems to be a different strain, a different tack, a different approach to what's being said. And it may be a genuine, listen, guys, don't expect too much from me.
Yeah, and then Brunel goes, actually, you can still win the Tour.
Yes, he does. We'll come on to that in a second. Just the quote from Lance himself. He was talking to ESPN.com's Bonnie Ford. The interesting part was, he says, I'm close to 39 and I'm racing guys in their mid-20s. Although I must say about this current generation of riders, I truly believe that they are better than the guys I raced when I was 30. So all of the rivals that we had in those years, I don't think they compare to Andy Schleck or to Alberto Contador or indeed to Frank Schleck.
Duh.
So I was just going to ask the question. I mean, I would agree with that as well.
I mean, to be honest, one of the great difficulties and something that Eric Bowen's tried to tackle is comparing riders of different eras. And I genuinely feel now that 2002, 2003 feel like a different era to me than today's sport. If they had the same, and I'm not using this in my usual pejorative sense, if they had the same preparation and training as the riders today.
Well, you mean not pejorative, but pharmacological sense?
No, I mean, I'm not talking about doping. But if they had the same nutritional information, you know, the same training information, the same training tools, I think your Mercs, your Eno and everybody would still be up there today. But I think Lance is right. You know, you look at Contador and you look at the Schlecks. I mean, where he was able to do the damage at the peak of his career, those guys would have been hanging with him. And there was nobody doing that at the time.
Yeah.
You know, think of Sestriere.
Yeah, I mean, I was just about to say there, I looked back just to see, because it's easy to remember who wins, but it's not quite as easy to remember who the rivals were across those tours that Lance won.
Speak for yourself.
Well, that's because I'm going as senile as you. Alex Zula, Jan Ulrich, Yuseba Bolocki, Ivan Basso, Andreas Klodin, Carlos Sastry and Alexander Vinokourov formed that group of second and third across.
And Schleck and Contador would be any of them.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Now, as John alluded to a moment ago, talking to Belgian newspaper Het Nieuwsblad, Johan Brunel has said that Alberto Contador can be beaten at this year's Tour de France, although the Radio Shack DS admits that they are indeed the underdogs.
I tell you, he can be beaten. I've never said he couldn't be. I've said in a head-to-head fight he can't be beaten. I think he's crapping himself about the cobbles.
Yeah, I think the first week is make or break for Contador.
He's absolutely crapping himself about the cobbles, because it'd be the easiest thing in the world to fall off and snap your collarbone or whatever. I think he's probably less worried about Astana than he was, because, I mean, they've shown themselves to have more depth as a team than I expected them to this year, so there will be some support there. And Lance, as we saw last year, he's a savvy, savvy rider. So he's in the right place at the right time. All it takes is you know, the perfect storm of, you know, happening and consequence, and he could win an eighth.
Yeah. As you say, a perfect storm. Contador goes off in the first week, breaks a collarbone. The Schlecks have a bad day in the mountains, and
God forbid a doping scandal. Something like that.
Dot, 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 dot. There was a couple other points in that interview with Johan Brunel that I thought were interesting. He was talking about the fact that Astana is still Vino's team as it was when he was there. Even when Vino was suspended, he still felt, as DS for Astana across those 2 years, that it was still Alexander Vinokourov's team. And we've said that, you know, as long as the show has been going on. Yeah. What I thought was interesting, though, was there was a kind of insinuation that, listen, it's still Vino's team and that may be a factor when it comes to the Tour.
No, absolutely. I mean, Mike Shires on Twitter, said essentially he was worried that Vino would help Contador in the same way that he helped Ulrich.
Yes, when that's of course when Alexander Vinokourov was riding for T-Mobile, and I think had enough of his contract, and I can't remember what year that was. It must have been 2003, 2004, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. 2003, I think.
Where he was just essentially attacking at every opportunity. It made for great viewing, but terrible team sport.
And it is Vino's team. But, you know, all Contador needs, and he showed us this year, is for them to deliver him to the foot of the climb. And they're going to be doing that for Vino anyway. So in the way that even if it is Vino's team, Contador's going to get the support he needs because they'll deliver him where he needs to be to make the decisive difference. But there's a lot of, you know, dangers lurking in the first week of this week's, or this year's tour.
Yeah.
So he's going to have to be careful.
Well, I seriously had to check my calendar as I thought it was April the 1st when reading the following cycling news article. It says the UCI has played down media speculation that a type of mechanical doping could already exist in the peloton, saying there is no evidence that riders are utilising small motors to power their bikes and thus gain an unfair advantage. However, the UCI have confirmed to Cycling News that they are looking into a method of screening frames in order to remove any doubts.
This is cracking. This is a brilliant story.
I mean, seriously, I was going, am I right? Is it me? Is this a really, really late April Fool's joke?
The thing is, I looked at this and I thought, why have I never thought of that? And part of the reason you've never thought of it is, you know, we talked ad nauseum about the Zeppelin Halle at Eurobike.
Yeah.
All the really ugly batteries and all the really ugly motors on the e-bikes. And it can be done. I mean, the Go Cycle does it elegantly and nicely. But this there is a way to do it with it being invisible on a current race bike with something that's for sale, which I'll save for later on.
Yes, okay, before we get to that, I'll just kind of explain. Apparently on last Tuesday morning, the newspaper Le Avenir ran a story about what it termed were invisible motors that could be hidden within bike tubing and help to power a bike along. It suggested that a rider could utilise such a setup to save energy in the first, say, 5 hours of racing, then change to a standard bike and ride the finale with an unassisted machine. Another newspaper followed this story up on Wednesday, claiming that spot checks were already being carried out and saying that some of the bikes in Paris-Roubaix and at the Tour of Flanders had been scrutinised.
Let's think about this. Does anybody remember what Fuentes used to charge? There was, I think, €30,000 for one course of treatment was transferred mysteriously from a certain German's account into his bank account. And for that, you're probably looking at getting maybe a 20 or 30 watt boost, which is, I mean, it's a planet of power in the pro peloton. Here, they're talking about something that can save you 100 watts for 5 hours and cost, you know, a couple of hundred euros. That's progress. And it is actually invisible. So I wish I'd been the DS that thought of this, because this is brilliant cheating. You know, your guy can go and pee in a cup with complete confidence he's not going to get caught. And he's still, you know, he's saved a bucket load of energy during the course of a race, which has put him in a position to win.
Yeah. Speaking to Cycling News, the UCI's Enrico Carpani said there were no indications that riders had already tried to use such motors in races. We do not have any knowledge of this product as already in use in competitive cycling, he said. But our equipment commission will follow this issue very carefully because they are obviously interested in everything that could affect cycling in the future. The UCI is studying the machine to find a method to detect it. However, Marco Bognetti, a previous member of the Material Commission, spoke with a little more urgency. He said, "It's all true. There's a suspicion that there are teams and riders who use a pedal-assisted bike. We were first told about it last July during the Tour de France.
Brilliant.
We heard first about it from the USA and it set alarm bells ringing."
And I tell you, it's an idea whose time has come. Because 5-10 years ago, a wee button on your handlebars to turn on the motor would have been noticed and everybody would have gone, "The hell's that?
What's that wee button?"
You've
got
a button on your handlebar. Now you just go, "It's my DI2 secondary shifter."
Oh, further conspiracy, yeah.
Yeah, so
with electronic componentry now becoming
and look, there's a standard.
Look, there's a battery.
In fact, Colnago make a frame specifically for the battery,
which we talked about last week.
And that CFC team are doing really well, aren't they?
Well, we shall come. Right, moving on before we go any further down this line, and we will return to it further on in the show. Now, bicycles accounted for 75% of the morning roadway traffic on San Francisco's Market Street for the 16th annual Bike to Work Day, organised by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition and the City of San Francisco.
Yay, go San Francisco.
So it would seem...
75%, that's... Fair enough, it's only one street, and they probably picked the street that they knew people were going to cycle on.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's... For somewhere like San Francisco, that, let's be frank, isn't flat, then that's an impressive amount of bike use.
Yeah, Renny Riviera, acting executive director...
Made up name.
I'm sure it's not. ...of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition said, "I was thrilled to ride alongside Mayor Newsom and scores of smiling people this morning in the newly separated and green Market Street bike lanes. So many more people are bicycling on Market because they feel safer in these separated green bike lanes." Now, of course, we've spoken before about
segregation. It's mixed blessings.
Exactly. But I mean, 75%, that's an awesome thing.
It's a number that deserves respect.
Yeah. Now, moving a little closer to home, well, for us at least, we've talked at great length about bicycle sharing schemes in cities such as Paris, Barcelona and Montreal, but it looks like Edinburgh City Council chiefs are looking to severely cut back proposals for their own bicycle sharing scheme.
Which is... hardly a surprise, let's be blunt. I mean, I think Edinburgh... I've said before, it's not the worst city in the world to cycle in. They very seldom follow through fully on their commitments. You know, bicycle lanes are often half-baked or poorly finished. And to be blunt, a bit like San Francisco, Edinburgh is extremely hilly. It's built on seven hills.
Yeah.
And for the kind of bikes that you're going to get for a Valib scheme, for example... people are going to struggle to use them, so I'm not surprised to see it. It's not shelved yet, but then, you know, it looks like the writing's on the wall.
Despite signing up to the Charter of Brussels, I think we spoke about this a few weeks ago, which was a commitment to cycling, which would see bikes account for 15% of all journeys in Edinburgh by 2020. Yeah. And the bike hire scheme, which was to be a major element in the plan to reduce car dependency, is now being scaled back from a city-wide scheme to just a handful of bikes. I mean, that's...
Tokenism.
It's tokenism.
Just if you're not going to do it, just don't do it.
Precisely. You need the numbers to make it viable. This article was in the Scotsman newspaper, and I have to read one of the comments that was posted beneath it, which was just hilarious. It goes, "Cycling does not help the environment or climate change. Hippies, and they are hippies, primarily eat lentils, which means they fart a lot. Methane is one of the primary causes of climate change. Additionally, the smugness of these people generate has the slight warming effect, as does the way they make normal people's blood boil."
Yeah, fair dues.
Fair and considered comment, that.
No, like, actually, the methane thing's serious. Cow farts are a big problem
for global warming. Apparently so. What other podcast in the world can you go from bikes to?
To fart and cows.
Now, sticking with our beloved homeland, but moving across to the other side of the country, to Glasgow, where the White Bike Plan was supposed to be a highlight of the Glasgow International Art Festival, making a statement about anti-greed and healthy living.
Actually, this is the kind of pretentious twaddle that makes my blood boil.
Okay. According to the Herald Scotland, it would appear that the concept is being lost on some, with around 30 bikes still missing a week after the event ended.
Yeah. Bike schemes, okay? Fine. Mm-hmm. This is a reenactment of a piece of anarchist art. It's nothing to do, it's literally nothing to do with getting bikes in, you know, under people's bums. It's all about, you know, exploring the inner self through some poncy thing where you put 50 bikes out and 30 of them get nicked. This is more your terrain than mine, I'm telling you.
Oh, none taken. The £5,000 publicly funded project was based, as John has alluded to, the work of the 1960s Dutch anarchist movement Provo, and saw bikes fitted with identical combination locks and the number openly published on the internet. So I think basically, if you spotted a bike...
Have you been to Glasgow?
What do you mean, did I have been to Glasgow? I grew up in the outskirts of Glasgow.
This is, you'd be as well putting up a big sign saying free bikes here.
please nick me. Yeah. Basically, if you knew the number of the combination lock, you saw a bike, you went up, unlocked it, used it, locked it up again in the next person, so on and so forth. However, the bikes became increasingly hard to locate after the white cyclists failed to follow the original aims of the plan and return their bike at night to a number of festival locations. It has now been reported that two of the distinctive bikes which carried the white Fiat's logo have ended up in Germany.
Yeah, it's cool.
With another spotted in London.
My favourite thing with though, I think they told the police if they saw one of their bikes with somebody else's lock on it to take action. But some enterprising thief used the actual combination lock and changed the combination by one digit, so it looked like it was legitimate use, but it was their own personal bike. I like that.
Yeah. God bless
that's
Glasgow.
That's anarchic, that.
Well, I suppose they can't really complain, because if you're following the work of a Dutch anarchist movement, when members of the public react in their own anarchist fashion, you've not really got a leg to stand on, have you?
£5,000 of public money down the toilet. That's all I'm saying.
Now, Bike Hacks are currently running a competition, with the winner receiving a flashback, the lighting system for your backpack or pannier. Now, all you have to do is write a bicycle-related haiku poem.
See, this, you know the boy in The Scotsman that was going on about cyclists being mm-hmm. smug and blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah? How middle class is this? You run a competition where you have to write a haiku. Awesome.
And the competition deadline to submit your haiku is Tuesday the 1st of June. Of course, we'll put a link to the show notes, and we just really wanted to mention this.
I actually really like them. I mean, because
haikus are nice.
No stress, lacing wheels, one cross, two cross, three cross, four, true enlightenment.
My favourite was Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, Staten, Manhattan. I've biked them all while smiling. Drivers don't smile much.
Oh, past the Elgin 18.
Now, Hermes Sport is the brainchild of Alex Webster, whose vision with his company is to bring top-tier racing products to the masses. Now, following their first wheel set, the 50mm Deep Sport Aerodynamics, these new levitators are aimed at the amateur racing enthusiast.
The fairly well-off amateur racing enthusiast.
It has to be said.
What are they, $1,500?
$1,500 retail, yeah.
But for a sub-1 kilogram wheel set, I mean, this is the territory that lightweight were, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 a few years ago. It's nice. I mean, they look like nice, well-made rims. They're properly made with tune hubs. I mean, we love tune. I raved about tune after we were at the show last year.
Mm.
And they're built with things, you know, things like ordinary spokes that a bike shop could actually replace if something went wrong.
If something went terribly, terribly wrong, yeah.
So, you know, I've actually seen people with lightweight wheels out and about in Peebles, you know, where, to be frank, the only reason to have them is because you've got more money than you need. But for a serious racer, we can argue about lightweight versus aerodynamics and climbing bikes, and that's a different discussion. But this is a cutting-edge weight wheel set for the price of a perfectly ordinary set of Xeriums. So, you know, well done.
Yeah, definitely.
We actually got a row, sorry, for being too positive.
Too positive about what?
Because apparently in the last show we were too positive in all our reviews. People wanted more grouchiness. But I can't help it. I quite like these.
Well, see, the thing is that what actually makes it to the show is stuff that we like.
We should keep some of the crap.
There is some stuff that gets bookmarked and we go, that's just dull. We're not talking about that nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. We should keep some in just for amusement, because folk like us being grumpy, apparently.
Yeah, I think our picks of the week normally are reserved occasionally for the stuff that we really, really don't like, so we can post
this this week, I'm telling you.
No, it is not.
Anyway, next bit.
Right, okay. Anyway, these are 970 grams. Rider weight limit is 185 pounds, and
oops,
as I say,
be me out there.
may well be, and they retail for $1,499. Now, Stan's No Tubes are a forthcoming Robe tubeless wheel set which will use American Classic hubs laced to the lightweight sub 350 grand Alpha 340 ZTR road rim.
See, I'm really impressed, because the first two stories we've got in tech, you've got tune hubs in one and American Classics in the next. I mean, one of the highlights of the Eurobike trip that we want to duplicate with your kind of nations this year.
That was slick.
That's slick. I'm a professional. Was chatting to Bill Shook of American Classic. And this actually ties into tune, because I'd heard about Stans, which started off as a way to run essentially normal rims as a tubeless system with sealing tapes and, you know, fluid and all sorts of stuff. And I first saw them when I wandered into the European hall at Eurobike, and went to the tune stand, and it was the year I mean, you weren't there, but Tune had embedded all of their hubs and seat posts and stuff in fake plastic breakfast fried food. It was positively surreal. But even more surreal in the corner was a man with a wheel and a rack holding up a pointed, sharpened bradawl, handing it to the members of the public and getting them to stab a tyre.
As you do.
That was under full pressure. Yeah. And it was like the shower scene from Psycho. People just plunging this thing into the tyre. And it was, it's a good 2 millimetre diameter bradawl, sealed instantly with virtually no pressure loss.
Wow.
So tubeless, I think, is an idea whose time's arrived. I mean, we've had a request to look at tubeless as a result of one of the donations that we got for the Eurobike Fund. And I was going to do it anyway. Because you can run them at lower pressure for better traction.
Don't tell people that.
No, well, all right, I wasn't. Your money's made me look at... You can run them at lower pressure when you need greater traction. Pinch flats become a thing of the past. There's a lot of benefits to a tubeless tyre. Not least if you completely trash it to the point where it won't actually self-seal. You'll get messy, but you can actually just put an ordinary inner tube inside. Pump it up and run that till you get home. So... It's not just stands. There's going to be a lot of tubeless stuff happening this coming year, and I want to have a look at it.
Yeah. Now, if you have a BB30 bottom bracket but want to run the new Dura-Ace crank, up until now you may have been out of luck. However, Wheels Manufacturing could be about to come to your rescue with their new BB30 shims.
I just think these people deserve some recognition. The number of times they've saved my arse in the shop is... Well, it's probably 5 or 6. Wheels do all those weird things like replacement spacers for cassettes so that you can run Campy on Shimano and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They do a fantastic gear hanger saver. But this is great because BB30, we know the advantages of it. We've talked about it with a lower Q factor and, easy installation and that sort of thing. But there's loads of really nice... slightly older, I mean not much older, but slightly older cranksets out there that people will have that are still perfectly usable. But if you buy a modern frame with, with BB30, you can't use. Mm-hmm. This is, what, $40 or something?
$36.99, so nothing.
Yeah. And going by wheel stuff, it'll work well, and it lets you use whatever crank you've got. You change your frame this year, but you've got a really nice Dura-Ace group set. Fine. Spend $36, you can use it.
Yeah. Now, Saxobank riders at the Tour of California have been using a special edition of the Specialized SL3 that has a paint job and retro graphics scheme to commemorate the original Specialized Alley bikes used in the 1985 movie American Flyers.
You ever seen it?
I don't, because when I was reading this, I thought, I don't think I've seen this film.
I'll burn it on a DVD for you.
Thank you.
It's truly awful.
Okay, don't bother then.
It's got Kevin Costner with a caterpillar living in his upper lip.
I don't think I can probably say with as much certainty as I can muster it without having IMDb in front of me, there hasn't been a single Kevin Costner movie I've enjoyed.
Oh, come on, The Bodyguard was lovely.
Anyway, God.
Neither here nor there. Field of Dreams is all right.
Build it and they will come.
Aye. The reason I wanted to talk about this, actually, is I want to ask a favour.
Of me?
No, of our lovely listeners.
Of our beloved listeners.
The finish of the classic Specialized Alley is, it's essentially this, that they've duplicated. It's that beautiful red colour. Now, I actually want a second generation steel alley. Ideally in red, ideally in 56 centimetres, and to be really picky, ideally with a steel fork. And I can't find one anywhere. So if anybody's got an early 90s Specialized Alley in steel in their cupboard and they want to sell it to me, get in touch. That's it. It's purely self-serving, that.
Okay. No worries. Actually, I quite enjoyed the roadbikeaction.com. I've got a kind of side-by-side comparison of the 80s Alley to this Special Edition.
80s Alley was a horny beast.
Cracking. Yeah. Absolutely cracking.
And I mean, I really regret selling that bike, which is why I'm trying to buy one. It's the second favourite steel bike I've ever had, which for a mass-produced bike, for me, says something about the bike. And the guy that I sold it to is in Peebles, still rides it every day and refuses to sell it back to me. So I'm seriously thinking about running him over when he's
running. Well, I was going to say, I know some people, just say the word, he'll be sleeping with the fishes.
Yeah, he's a nice bloke.
And on that bombshell, I think it's probably time for some picks of the week. Well, as seems to be par for the course these days, shall go first. And a couple of weeks ago, Rafa, purveyors of highly priced, but let's face it, highly stylish cycling apparel, opened a club in London, which they say is as a combination of gallery, club and, of course, shop.
Aye, okay.
Okay. They're looking at this as a kind of drop-in centre for those like-minded individuals looking to share the rarefied Rafa air. And they've been showing the Giro and Tour of California live on a big screen, and have also got plans to show the Dauphiné, the Tour of Switzerland, and of course the Tour de France when it comes round in July. So I can kind of see the point of this. It's, as I say, it's somewhere that you can go and like you would go and watch the football in a bar, in a pub somewhere. You could go and drop into the Rafa Club and watch the Giro, for example. However, my pick isn't necessarily the club itself, but the fact that they're currently holding a Fausto Coppi exhibition throughout May, and they've also got one on the Col de Tourmalet coming up in June. Well, July will see an exhibition of vintage racing bikes where 10 original bikes from the last 100 years of the Tour de France will be on show, offering, as they put it, a rare insight into the technology that has carried Tour de France riders to victory over the years. So if you happen to find yourself in London over the next couple of months, even if you're not a fan of Rafa, pop in to see,
because
there's some
cool,
cracking look. Even the I've seen pictures of the Coppi exhibition, and there's some cracking looking stuff there. So that's my pick of the week. The exhibition's forthcoming over the next 2 or 3 months at the Rafa Club.
Okay.
Your pick.
Okay. My pick is the Gruber Assist.
Now, before we go any further, we have alluded to the Gruber Assist earlier in the show, because this indeed is the technology that has been pointed at in terms of mechanical doping.
This is genius. It's absolute genius.
In Explain essence, and expound.
It's an electric motor in the form of a tube, which will fit inside any 31.6mm diameter seat tube.
Mm-hmm.
And it, by means of a wee grub gear on the bottom, it integrates with a bottom bracket. Because my first thought was, how will they hide the motor? And I was going on a bit complicated thoughts of, modified power tap hubs and all sorts of stuff. But here, there's no external parts at all. Particularly when you've got your, Colnago frame with its built-in battery mount. You get a boost of power, say 100 watts. I'm having a time trial bike built with a 31.6 seat post. This is brilliant.
And I just hope that your fellow competitors in said time trial don't listen to the Velocast.
Very little training. Pretend I've got DI2. Bob's your uncle. Suddenly I'm doing PBs. Fantastic. All joking aside, for a lot of people, this would be a useful thing because it doesn't make your bike look ugly. You know, if you've got some sense of aesthetics, you're going to turn your nose up at the vast majority of e-bikes. This will,
which is kind of something we've talked about.
No, absolutely. It's a crucial point. Acceptance is based around the fact they look nice, and most of them don't. So you can get something that even looks like a fast road bike. You know, because the vast majority of racing bikes these days are 31.6, and mountain bikes, it's almost ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So you can get a bike that looks horny, you can get a meaningful amount of power assist that lasts for a decent amount of time. The battery on this one, if you don't have the Colnago with a specially modified battery mount, it just fits in a seat pack underneath. You could use it to cheat, but I'd like to see people use it just to make their cycling a bit easier.
Make the world a better place.
The only disadvantage is it's £1,700. Well, but compare that against the price of a dose of EPO. it's a bargain.
What I was going to say was compare that to against
the peace
price
of mind that when you have a pee, you're going to be fine.
I was going to say compare it against the price of your average e-bike, which is probably round about that. You factor in the cost of a bike plus the e-bike.
Oh, no,
modifications.
The point is, it's
you
a really,
have to get down the doping line.
It's a really, really stealthy way to do it. Which, I mean, you could do it from the, Gruber Electric Assist, £1,700. Peace of mind when you pee in a bottle, priceless.
Priceless. Yeah.
So you could do it from that point of view. But, as I say, for people with some sense of aesthetics, some sense of style, it'll give them a pedal assist bike with no speed limit, which is the really important thing if you're going for PBs or trying to cheat. Although they do say on the site they'll be happy to limit it to 25 kph if you want them to. It gives you a realistic solution without it looking like you're riding on something you bought for Walmart and slapped a car battery on the back.
Yeah. Okay. great, if somewhat worryingly conspiratorial pick.
I'm serious, I was really chuffed actually. Ellis Briggs and Mercy and started following us on Twitter today, which is a real, I'm quite proud of that. So Mercy and Ellis Briggs, get ready for an order for a low pro frame with a 31.6 each. Just saying.
Just saying. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Now, before we wrap up today, Velocast team jerseys.
Aye, we want your money now.
We spoke last week about the notion of having a Velocast team jersey and how we'd spoken to Schutt Velo Rapide about making them, as we felt that the quality of the jerseys would be absolutely fantastic and would be just what we're looking for. We've had a fantastic response over the past week.
Thanks, folks.
What we're essentially going to do is, as I say, we're now taking proper pre-orders, and we'll have a facility on the website where we can do that, hopefully by the end of the week. So just keep checking velocast.co.uk for where you can buy the jersey. I think VR we're looking at delivery by middle of June.
I think middle of June's realistic, and it's not like stocking a shop. I mean, part of the reason that we somewhat cringingly ask you for money from occasion to occasion is that we started this off as a hobby. You know, we were having conversations, which Scotty, over a period of time, convinced me we should broadcast, and, you know, forgot, you know, people are interested, who knows why. But the one basic rule we always had was it shouldn't affect our family finances. So it's not like a shop, you know, where I can just decide X amount of, you know, that week's takings go towards buying stock of jerseys that you subsequently buy. We actually are going to have to ask for your money up front. The price of the jersey, and I mean, I had a pick for Simon Lam's Gazzetta della Bici jersey a couple of weeks ago, and that came in at £50. Ours is a bit more complicated. Well, it's actually quite a lot more complicated. We're going to have to price it at £62.50 for a jersey, which, if you think they sell a similar one on Shut for kind of £80 for, you know, for a plain jersey. And if you look at the prices of certain people who are doing art shows in London and who have their jerseys made in Vietnam for a sport wool jersey.
And remember, who are no way connected with my pick of the week.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And remember, this is a sport wool jersey. It's not a crappy piece of polyester team kit. It's something that you can wear casually and on the bike and, you know, perform well in both places. £62.50 is damn fair. Shipping will be somewhere between a fiver and a tenner, depending on where you are in the world. And you'll get a damn stylish jersey.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks so much for listening, staying subscribed, and of course helping us produce this show with your contributions. All manner of ways to contact us can be found on our website at www.velocast.co.uk, where you can also find out how to donate or subscribe. Don't forget, you can also help us produce our Eurobike coverage this year at the Eurobike 2010 project page, so you should check out the website for more details on that. If you enjoy the show, please consider leaving a comment or review in iTunes, as this really helps other people discovering it. Well, I hope you all have a great week and look forward to speaking to you all again next week for another edition of the Velocast.